Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dr. Walter Dean for the show called Getting It Done. I've had a few listeners ask me what background and expertise do I have in the field of race relations. So instead of telling them over the phone, I decided to let you know on my show something about that particular topic. First, I took courses in cultural development and black history at the University of Hartford in West Hartford, Connecticut, and received training in leadership in a project called Project Real at Temple University in Philadelphia. Taught courses in the black experience and black history at University of Massachusetts, Springfield College, University of Hartford, University of Connecticut, and I was the president for the Greater Hartford NAACP, as well as state chairperson for the NAACP for the state of Connecticut. However, I don't want to continue. There's so much more, but I still have a shoulder to have I have to do, as opposed to propping myself up egotistically. Let's begin first. I would really want you to clearly understand the effects of racism, because you look, it's very difficult, evidently, for some people to totally understand what racism is as it relates to this particular country. So let's go back to the 1930s. Maybe you can deal with this in Germany during the Hitler time. He indicated that his race of people were the master race and were superior to all other races of people on earth. As a result, he gassed over 8 million Jewish people to make his point. Going further, two black men from this country, the United States, came out in a situation that made Hitler lose half of the little bit of mind that he had. That was Jesse Owens and Joe Louis. Jesse Owens and Louis proved there was no such thing as an Aryan superior group of people. The results of all of that concepts that Hitler projected, the results were being 8 million Jewish people lost their lives. Now, if you don't understand that and relate it to the number of black people and the problems that they're having today and have had for the last 300 plus years, let's go on and talk about, in a time of mourning and anger over the ongoing violence inflicted on black communities by police in the U.S. and the lack of accountability for national leaderships, what is the path forward? So let's listen to Chuck Anderson and Whitney Rogers pontificate.
Hello, thank you, Nancy. Welcome back for another live conversation. Big one today, big as they get. You know, when we created this Build Back Better series, our thought was, how could we address issues arising after the pandemic? How could we imagine building back from that? But the events of this past week, the horrific death of George Floyd and the daily protests that have followed, I mean, they provided a new urgency, which we, of course, simply have to address. I mean, can we build back better from this? I think before we can even start to answer that question, we just have to seek to understand the immensity of this moment.
Yeah, that's right, Chris. Right now, so many people in the United States and beyond are grappling with feelings of anger and frustration, deep sadness, and really helplessness. No matter who you are, your questions about what to do now, how to make things better. And as we've seen violence like this unfold for many, many years, what is the path forward?
So we're joined today by a group of activists, organizers, and leaders known for their crucial work in social justice and civil rights. We're so grateful to have them here to engage in a discussion about racial injustice in America, the unbearable acts of violence that against the black community that we witnessed. The dangers to a nation riven by anger and fear, and how on earth we can move forward from this to something better. So first, each of our four guests will share their thoughts on how we move forward from this moment, and then we'll engage as a group, including you, the TED community.
And we'd like to thank our partners, the Project Management Institute. Their generous support has helped make today's interviews possible. And of course, as Chris mentioned, we want you to take part in the conversation. So please share your questions using our Ask a Question feature and continue to share your thoughts in the discussion thread.
Thanks, Winnie. Okay, let's get this moving. Our first guest. Dr. Philip Atiba-Goff is the founder of and CEO of the Center for Policing Equity. They work with police departments across America, including in Minneapolis, to seek measurable responses to racial bias. So I can scarcely imagine how distressing the last 6 months have been for you. Welcome, and over to you for your opening comments.
Thanks, Chris. Yeah, this week has been a gut punch to anybody who felt like we could be making progress in the way that we put forward public safety that empowers particularly vulnerable communities. We started working in Minneapolis about 5 years ago. At the time, it was like most major cities in the United States, a department that had a long history of unaccounted for violence from law enforcement targeting the most vulnerable black communities. And we try to put into place a number of things that we know work. Change the culture so that the culture can be accountable to the values of the community. And what we saw was small but measurable progress. We always knew with small and measurable progress that you're one tragic incident from going back to ground zero. But the events of the last week and a half haven't brought us back to ground zero. They've torched ground zero and we've dug a hole we have to dig ourselves out of. What I hear from police chiefs who call me, from activists I talk to, from folks in the communities that are literally on fire right now, I hear folks saying, I had one activist say to me, that the pain that he was feeling was too large to fit into his body. Without thinking about it, I said right back, that's because it's too large to fit into a lifetime. What we're seeing isn't just the response to one gruesome, cruel, public execution, a lynching. It's not just the reaction to three of them, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and then George Floyd. What we're seeing is the bill come due for the unpaid debts that this country owes to its black residents. And it comes due usually every 20 to 30 years. It was Ferguson just 6 years ago. About 30 years before that, it was in the streets of Los Angeles after the verdict that exonerated the police that beat Rodney King on video. It was Newark. It was Watts. It was Chicago. It was Tulsa. It was Chicago again. If we don't take a full accounting of these debts that are owed, then we're going to keep paying it. Part of what I've been experiencing in the last week and a half and what I've been sharing with the people who do this work, who are serious about it, is the acknowledgement, the soul-crushing reality that at some point, when things stop being on fire, the cameras are going to turn to something else. And the history that we have in this country is not just a history of vicious neglect and targeted abuse of black communities. It's also one where we lose our attention for it. And what that means for communities like in Baton Rouge, where those who still grieve Alton Sterling, and in Baltimore, for those who are still grieving Freddie Gray, is that there is not just a chance, there's a likelihood that we are a month or 2 months out from this with no more to show for it than what we had to show after Michael Brown Jr. And holding the weight of that individually and collectively is just too much. It's just too heavy a load for a person or a people or a generation to hold up. What we're seeing is the unrepented sins, the unpaid debts. And so the solution can't just be that we fix policing. It can't be only incremental reform. It can't be only systems of accountability to catch cops after they've killed somebody. Because there's no such thing as justice for George Floyd. There's maybe accountability. There's maybe some relief from the people who are still around who loved him, for his daughter, who spoke out yesterday and said, "My daddy changed the world." There won't be justice for a man who's dead when he didn't have to be. But we're not going to get to where we need to go just by reforming police. So in addition to the work that CPE is known for with the data, we have been encouraging departments and cities to take the money that should be going to invest in communities and take it from police budgets, bring it to the communities. People ask, well, what could it possibly look like? How could we imagine it? And I tell people, there is a place where we do this in the United States right now. We've all heard about it, whispered. Some of us have even been there. Some of us live there. The place is called the suburbs. But we already have enough resources to give to people so they don't need the police for public safety in the first place. If someone has a substance abuse issue, they can go to a clinic. If somebody has a medical issue, they can go, if they've got insurance, they can go to a hospital. If there's a domestic dispute, they have friends, they have support, right? You don't need to enter a badge and a gun into it. If we hadn't disinvested from all the public resources that were available in communities that most needed those, we wouldn't need police in the first place. And many have been arguing even more loudly recently that we don't. If we would just take the money that we use to punish and instead invest it in the promise and the genius of the community that could be there. So I don't know all the ways we're going to get there. I know it's going to take everything and. It's going to need the kind of systemic change and the management tools that we traditionally offer. And it's also going to need a quantum change in the way that we think about public safety. But mostly, this isn't just a policing problem. This is the unpaid debts that are owed to Black America. The bill is coming due. And we need to start getting an accounting together so we're not just paying off the interest of the damn thing.
Thank you. So, Rashad Robinson is the president of Color of Change, the civil rights organization that advocates for racial justice for the Black community. To date, more than 4 million people have signed a petition to arrest the officers involved in the murder of George Floyd. And, of course, one was arrested last week. Thank you so much for being with us, Rashad. Welcome.
Thank you, and thank you for having me. It's an opportunity that I'm taking today to just tell you about how you can get involved, how you can take action, because right now strategic action is critical for all of us to do the work to change the rules that far too often keep the systems in place that hold us back. Make no mistake, the criminal justice system is not broken. It is operating exactly the way it was designed. It's at every single level, the criminal justice system is not about providing justice, but about ensuring that certain people, certain communities are protected while other communities are violated. And so I want to talk a little bit today about Color of Change, about activism, about the work that's happening on the ground from other organizations all around the country, and the way that you can channel this energy. When we talk about at Color of Change is how you channel presence into power. And far too often we mistake presence and visibility for power. Presence retweet the stories of the movement. People feeling passion about change can sometimes make us feel like change is inevitable, but power is actually the ability to change the rules. And right now, everyday people are taking action, and what we're trying to channel that energy into is a couple of things. First is a whole set of demands at the federal level and at the local level. As Phil described, that policing, operates on many different channels. And what we need to recognize is that while there are a lot of things that can happen at the federal level, locally all around the country, there are decisions that are being made in communities around how policing is executed, where community needs to hold a deeper level of accountability. At the state level, we need new laws. So at Color of Change, we've built a whole platform around a set of demands that are working to build more energy of everyday people to take action. We're fighting for justice for Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and George Floyd. We're also fighting for justice for other folks whose names that you haven't heard, Nina Pop and others, whose stories of injustice and the relationship to the criminal justice system represent all the ways in which fighting right now is important. Over the last couple of years, we have worked to build a movement to hold district attorneys accountable and to change the role of district attorneys in our country. And through the Winning Justice platform at Color of Change, www.winningjustice.org, what we have worked to do is channel the energy of everyday people to take action. So for folks who are watching what's happening on TV, seeing it on their social media feeds and are outraged about what's happening in Georgia, what's happening in Tennessee, what's happening in Minnesota, you yourself probably, most likely, live in a place, in a community, where you have a district attorney that will not hold police accountable, that will not prosecute police when they harm, hurt black folks, when they violate the laws. You live in a community where police are part of the structure that is racking up mass incarceration, but many other aspects of our system are racking up mass incarceration, and district attorneys are at the center of it. You live in those communities, and you need to do something about it. And so at winningjustice.org, we've created the only searchable national database on the 2,400 prosecutors around the country. We're building local squads and communities for folks to be able to engage around efforts to hold DAs accountable. We've worked with our partners across the movement, from our friends in Black Lives Matter to folks who do policy work, to our friends at local ACLU chapters around the country, to build six demands that folks can get behind in terms of pushing for reform, and then we build public education material. But the only way that we work to change the way that prosecution happens in this country is that if people get involved, if people raise their voice, if people join us in pushing for real change. At the end of the day, I want people to recognize, though, and Phil talked a little bit about this, is that people don't experience issues, they experience life. That the forces that hold us back are deeply interrelated. A racist criminal justice system requires a racist media culture to survive. A political inequality follows economic inequality. They all go hand in hand. And so I also want us to not take ourselves out of the equation. We likely work inside of corporations that may post symbols for Black Lives Matter one day and then support politicians that work to destroy Black Lives Matter the next day. We oftentimes are engaged in practices inside of our companies or in our daily lives supporting media properties and others that are harming our communities or telling stories. Recently, we produced a report at Color of Change with the Norman Lear School at USC. It's called Normalizing Injustice, and it can be found at changehollywood.org. And Normalizing Injustice looks at the 22 crime procedurals, those crime shows on TV, and looks at all of the ways in which they sort of create a warped perception about our view of justice. They create sort of an incentive for the type of policing we see on the country and actually serve as a PR arm for law enforcement. We've been working in writers' rooms around the country to work to push folks to tell better stories, but we need folks to be both active listeners and we need folks in the industry to push back and challenge those, not only the structures that lead to that content coming on the air, but the proliferation across our airwaves. At the end of the day, we have an opportunity in this moment to make change. Inflection points are those moments where we have an opportunity to make huge leaps forward or the real threat of falling backwards. In our hands is the ability to do some incredible things about undoing so many of the injustices that have stood in the way of progress for far too long. But everyday people must get involved. We must channel that presence into power, and we must build the type of power that changes the rules. Racism, in so many ways is like water pouring over a floor with holes in it. In every single way, it will find the holes. And so for us, we cannot simply accept charitable solutions to structural problems, but we actually have to work for structural change. And so I want to end by saying one thing about how we talk about Black people and how we talk about Black communities in this moment, because we have to say what we mean, and we have to build the narrative that gets us to where we want to go. So far too often, we talk about Black communities as vulnerable. We talk about Black people as vulnerable. But vulnerability is a personal trait. Black communities have been under attack. Black communities have been exploited. Black communities have been targeted. And we need to say that so we don't put the onus on fixing Black families and Black communities, but we put the onus on fixing the structures that have harmed us. We will say things like Black people are less likely to get loans from banks instead of saying that banks are less likely to give loans to Black people. This is our opportunity to build the type of progress that makes real change. And at that center of the story, we need to show and elevate the images, not just of the pain that we are facing, but of the joy, the brilliance, and the creativity that Black people have brought to this country. Black people are the protagonists of this story, and we need to make sure that as we work to build a new tomorrow, we ensure that the heroes are at the center of the liberation that we all need. Thank you.
Thank you, Rashad. Dr. Bernice King is the CEO of the King Center in Atlanta, Georgia. The center is a living memorial to her father, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. It's dedicated to inspiring new generations to carry his work forward. In this moment when so many are hurting, how can we better approach unity and collective healing? Dr. King, over to you.
My eye is a little heavy right now because I was at 6 years old. I was 5 years old when my father was assassinated. And he did change the world. But the tragedy is that we didn't hear what he was saying to us as a prophet to this nation. And his words are now reverberating back to us. Change, we all know, is necessary right now. And yet it's not easy. We know that there has to be changes in policing in this nation of ours. But I want to talk about America's choice on a greater level. The prophet said to us, we still have a choice today. Nonviolent coexistence or violent co-annihilation. What we have witnessed over the last 8 days has placed that choice before us. We have seen literally in the streets of our nation people who have been following the path of nonviolent protest and people who have been hell-bent on destruction. Those choices are now looking at us, and we have to make a choice. The history of this nation was founded in violence. In fact, my father said, America is the greatest purveyor of violence. And the only way forward is if we repent for being a nation built on violence. And I'm not just talking about physical violence. I'm talking about systemic violence. I'm talking about policy violence. I'm talking about what he spoke of as the triple evils of poverty, racism, and militarism. All violence. Albert Einstein said something to us. He said, we cannot solve problems on the same level of thinking in which they were created. And so if we are going to move forward, we are going to have to deconstruct these systems of violence that we have set America, and we're going to have to reconstruct on another foundation. That foundation happens to be love and nonviolence. And so as we move forward, we can correct course if we make that choice that Daddy said, nonviolent coexistence. and not continue on the pathway of violent co-annihilation. So what does that look like? That looks like some deconstruction work in order to get to the construction. We have to deconstruct our thinking. We got to deconstruct the way in which we see people and deconstruct the way in which we operate, practice, and engage and set policy. And so I believe that there's a lot of heart, H-E-A-R-T work to do in the midst of all the H-A-R-D, hard work to do. Because heart work is hard work. One of the things we have to do is we have to ensure that everyone, especially my white brothers and sisters, have to engage in the heart work, the anti-racism work in our hearts. No one is exempt from this, especially in my white community. We must do that work in our hearts, the anti-racism work. The second thing is that I encourage people to look at the nonviolence training that we, the King Center, thekingcenter.org, so that we learn the foundation of understanding our interrelatedness and interconnectedness. That we understand our loyalties and our commitments and our policy making can no longer be devoted to one group of people, but has to be devoted to the greater good of all people. And so I'm inviting people to even join us on our online protest that's happening every night at 7 o'clock p.m. on the King Center Facebook page, because so many people have things that they want to express and contribute to this. We all have to change and have to make a choice. It is a choice to change the direction that we have been going. We need a revolution of values in this country. That's what my daddy said. He changed the world. He changed hearts. And now, what has happened over the last 7, 8 years and through history, we have to change course. And we all have to participate in changing America with a true revolution of values where people are at the center and not profit, where morality is at the center and not our military might. America does have a choice. We can either choose to go down continually that path of destruction, or we can choose nonviolent coexistence. And as my mother said, struggle is a never-ending process. Freedom is never really won. You earn it and win it in every generation. Every generation is called to this freedom struggle. You as a person may want to exempt yourself, but every generation is called. And so I encourage corporations in America to start doing anti-racism work within corporate America. I encourage every industry to start doing anti-racism work and pick up the banner of understanding nonviolent change personally and from a social change perspective. We can do this. We can make the right choice to ultimately build the beloved community. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. King. Anthony Romero is the executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union. As one of the nation's oldest social justice organizations, the ACLU has advocated for racial equality and shown deep support to the Black community in moments of crisis. And in moments like these, Black voices are almost always the loudest and at times the silence from our non-Black white brothers, non-Black brothers and sisters can feel deafening. How we can bring our allies into the mix to better support ending systemic violence and racism against the Black community is a question top of mind for a lot of us. Anthony, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for being with us.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Whitney. Thank you, Chris, for inviting me to join the TED community. I think community is really important right now. With so many of us feeling the trepidation, the weariness, the anger, the fear, the frustration, the terrorism that we've experienced in our communities, this is a time to huddle around a virtual campfire with your posse, with your family, with your loved ones, with your network. It's not a time to be isolated or alone. And I think for allies in this struggle, those of us who don't live this experience every day, it is time for us to lean in. And you can't change the channel. You can't tune out. You can't say, this is too hard. It is not that hard for us to listen and learn and heed. It is the only way we're going to build out of this, by hearing the voices of Rashad and Phil and Dr. King, by hearing the voices of our neighbors and loved ones, by hearing the voices on Twitter, people who we don't know. And so white communities and allied organizations need to pay even closer attention. This is the test of your character. How willing are you willing to lean in and to engage? For me, I have, these have been really hard couple weeks. I feel like this is really a test of whether or not we really believe in the American experiment. Do we really believe it? Do we really believe that out of many, one, that a country with no unifying language, no unifying culture, no unifying religion, can we really become one people, all equal before the law, all bound together with belief in the rule of law? Do we really believe that, or do we just think it's a nice saying to see on the back of a paper dollar? And for me, this is a referendum on the American experiment, on whether we really believe. And the future is in our hands, and this is not like other crises. I've been the head of the ACLU for almost 20 years. I feel like I've seen it all. This is different. And this is different because it is cumulative, like Phil and Rashad and Dr. King told us. This is centuries of systemic discrimination, and the bill has come due, and it will continue to be due, and we will pay unless we really do something quite different. I have been scratching my head at the ACLU for the last week. We've been at this for 100 years. My organization's been working on this from its inception. In 1931, we were involved with this report about lawlessness in law enforcement. That was our first report that we got behind in 1931. We opened up our first storefronts, you know, after the riots in Watts, so that we could bring legal services and lawyers to the community so they could demand justice from the police departments. You know, we brought Miranda, you know, the right to remain silent. We brought Gideon, the right to a court-appointed attorney if you can't afford one. We fought Bloomberg on stop and frisk. It took him years and a loss in front of our litigation to finally apologize. We've been at this for 100 years. And for the communities that have lived this for 400 years, I've been scratching my head thinking, it ain't working. We don't need another pattern and practice lawsuits. We need another training program on racial bias or implicit bias in police departments. We don't need to find another lawsuit on qualified immunity. We don't need to kind of bring another race discrimination or gender discrimination lawsuit to integrate the police departments. Yeah, we've done that, and we will continue to do that. For me, where I've come is that we need to defund the budgets of these police departments. The only way we're going to take power back. And the more I've read over the last couple of weeks about where this country is, the more I'm clear that that is my North Star at the moment. We will continue to bring the litigation on qualified immunity. We will do the efforts to hold unaccountable law enforcement officials accountable. We will bring patterns and practice lawsuits because the Justice Department is not doing that. So we will continue doing all that good work. But the real thing is we're going to go after those budgets. When you look at the fact that we spend $100 million on police, more than incarceration, that the city of Minneapolis spent 30% of their budget on policing, the city of Oakland's 41% on policing. That when you have New York City Police Department spends more money on policing than it does on housing and preservation development, community youth services, homelessness, we're going after the money. And we're, that's hardcore advocacy. Bills dropped in local legislatures to cut the funding for police, to stop these programs that give the federal military surplus to police departments so they become like little mini armies. These don't look like police officers. These look like standing armies, and the enemy are communities of color. So we need to take away their toys. We need to cut their budgets. We need to shrink the police infrastructure so that we can get police out of the quotidian lives of people of color and communities of color. The ubiquitousness of police enforcement and things that the police do not have a role, should not have a role to play. People do not, should not lose their lives over whether or not a cigarette pack has a proper tax stamp or whether a $20 bill is forged or not. That's not worthy of spending our dollars on police. Get them out of that business. Let's focus on the most important and the most serious of crimes, and that's it. That's it. We're going to de-police our communities. Shrink those budgets. We're going to reinvest those monies in local communities. It will be like water on stone campaigns. Local legislatures, local city councils, lab report cards, for people who talk out of both sides of their mouth and say, we believe in police reform, and yet they're still going to vote for 30 or 40% for the police? Mm-hmm. So we're going to put that right to the public. And I think we just have to stay at it, because I think that's the only way we can go get at this in a different way, because much of what we try to do is just simply not working. You know, with that, I struggle with how do you find the optimism in this moment, because you have to find the optimism. You have to find the way that can I still think that even though in the face of so many setbacks, there's been change. It's been too little, too slow, not enough. We need to kind of rocket boost it. But you can't lose sight of the optimism. And, you know, I've been thinking about who are the folks who inspire me, Dr. King's father, of course, and the words of Rashad and Patrice Cullors and others have inspired me. But I found inspiration in the words of the kind of a scholar I really don't like very much, Sam Huntington, kind of often criticizes being a conservative or racist. But sometimes you can find inspiration even in your enemy's words. And in his, one of his books, which I pulled off the shelf I had, it's just, he writes about how America is a disappointment because it failed to live up to its aspirations. And he actually started talking about it as America is a failure because it doesn't live up to its ideals. But it's not a failure, not a bunch of lies. It's a disappointment. And in the disappointment also is the fact that there's hope. I'm paraphrasing it, but I think we have to kind of wrap all of that together and think about the disappointment and the hope and the resolve to do better. And we need to listen and lean in. And I thank the TED community. I thank Dr. King. I thank Rashad. I thank Phil. Thank you.
Thank you to all four of you. That was astonishing. I guess we're bringing everyone back now to have a conversation among us, to ask some questions from our community. I hope you're entering those questions. So I don't know whether we can bring back our guests onto the screen at this point. Welcome back. I guess I'll start, let me start with the question to you, Dr. King. I was so inspired by what you said. Your father, of course, also deeply understood the anger that leads to protest. I think he said that protests are the language of the unheard. And I'm wondering what you would say to someone right now who is angered beyond measure by what's happened and also sees this could be the moment, you know, like somebody believes that the system is so fundamentally broken that our best choice is to tear it down, that is actually this may be a once-in-a-generational moment to do that. And so to actually believe that protests, including violent protests, actually is the way right now. What would you say to someone who's felt that?
First, I just wanted to make a slight correction. You said riots are the language of the unheard.
That is the point even more powerfully. Yeah.
Protest we must, and we must continue to always protest to keep the issues and the awareness before people. But, you know, when a person is angry, sometimes it's hard to reach them. I've been on that journey. I was at a stage in my life where I was so angry I wanted to destroy, and I'm the daughter of Martin Luther King Jr. And grew up in a household of love and nonviolence and forgiveness. And I had to go through that journey. I was surrounded by the right kind of influences, fortunately, because that would have been a sad story. But I think it's really allowing ourselves to hear the anger and allowing the space for the anger, but also trying to help young people rechannel that energy. And we've got to start ensuring that we connect them to some of the work that has been and now is elevated to another place. Color Change, the work that you're doing, the ACLU, the work that they're doing. Because sometimes there's this disconnection that intensifies the emotion and makes you feel helpless. But if you can channel that anger, connect it with action that is toward creating the social and economic change, then it begins to build you up, and then you can begin to become more constructive with the anger.
Great. We have some questions that are coming in from our community, but before we do that, you all shared such powerful, meaningful statements right now, and many of you touched on the fact that this is not the first time that we're experiencing this, the murder of George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor. This is one of, these are three of many, many instances just like this. And I'd love to hear you all address what has sort of brought us to this boiling point, to what has contributed to this moment where we're now experiencing things, as Anthony, as you said, that feels so much worse than other moments. And that's it. Anyone who feels comfortable to take that question.
Rashad, I want to hear you.
I wanted to say something to that. I think we've always been at that moment. But this moment is different because of the void in leadership. There's no real moral voice in our country, and the person who sits in the office of the presidency is not, leading in the right way. And so it is, and has kind of, well, not kind of, has given license to certain things. And so now it's, he's lit the fires.
The thing I'll add here is that, I think a couple of things. For the last couple of months, we have been both seeing and experiencing all of the ways that this country's decisions of underinvestment, of targeting Black communities, has been killing Black people through COVID. And while we've been in our homes, we have also been watching how the media has blamed us, as we have been the essential workers in so many places, and trying to ensure that this country keeps going. We've watched white men with guns show up to Capitols with demanding basically Black and brown people go back to work. And then we see this 8-minute video with the police officer with his knee on someone's neck after seeing that video of Ahmaud Arbery and hearing the story of Breonna Taylor, and we see him looking in the camera, basically knowing that America was not going to punish him. And what I think is that it's just enough is enough, that people didn't feel that they had a channel for that outrage. And because people had been inside, and because people had been experiencing all the ways in which the structures had also been colluding to kill us, that what we're seeing is a alignment of all of those things, where people are making demands that are much bigger and much bolder than before. And we recognize that while we don't have leadership at the federal level, we also have to recognize that no political party can say that they have been 100%, either political party can say they've been 100% on the right side of all these issues. And so people are mobilizing. They are fighting back and like never before. And in some ways, people are unwilling to accept answers like just go vote or just participate in the process, because we recognize that Black people have been voting. Black people have been part of voting and part of ensuring that. And so that, I think, is why this moment feels so much different, combined with for the last 7 years since Trayvon, we have seen the growth of a new movement of activists and leaders all around the country who are also in a very different place to be able to move the needle on so much of what's possible.
We have a question here from Genesis B. Let's see if we can get that up here. Here in Mississippi, the police is synonymous with the Klan historically. How do we purge law enforcement of white supremacists?
So I guess that's partially to me, being the psychologist of bias. I'll say that just yesterday, we had an officer in Denver who posted on social media himself and two other officers saying, let's go start a riot. He was fired that day. I worry about all the officers that the FBI has now for almost half a decade been warning us law enforcement and unions being infiltrated by white supremacists. And all the officers that have social media accounts, but they're private. The Invisible Institute has put some things forward. We're not talking seriously about the domestic terrorism threat that white supremacy represents. So the first thing we got to do is we got to take it seriously. We have to actually say out loud, and I can't believe that on a day like today, on a week like this week, I have to say out loud, white supremacy is alive and well and a driving force of American politics. This shouldn't be controversial. I shouldn't be looking forward to getting hate mail in my inbox for it, but that's the reality. So the first part of solving the problem is acknowledging it exists. But the second thing is we need to arm municipalities, that's law enforcement, but even more so communities, with the ability to take action when someone violates their values. Right now, I think about the case in Philadelphia where Charles Ramsey, when he was commissioner there, fired six officers, right? Concerns about racial bias and concerns about police brutality. And those six officers were back on the same job inside of 3 months. We now have a law enforcement system that says you can lose your job in one jurisdiction and get the same job as law enforcement in another jurisdiction. And without a national registry and the capacity for law enforcement to make different decisions, we're going to have this exact problem, not just in Mississippi, but in Minneapolis and Louisville, in New York and L.A.
So how much of the problem stems from the fact that police unions have a huge amount of power to protect and sometimes reinstate so-called bad apple officers?
Yeah, so I'm getting this question a lot, and police unions are one of the most powerful labor forces in the United States and are unique within the labor movement. Right, so the police unions and teachers unions are the two largest and could not be two different groups of folks. When I talk to union leadership, that's the leadership that wants to talk to Dr. Blackenstein, right? When I talk to union leadership, what they say is no one hates a bad officer more than a good officer. But the union contracts and union negotiations don't look like that's true. What they look like is anybody who gets in trouble, and the union's only job is to make sure whatever officer is in trouble gets to maintain their job. The perverse incentive here is that when people run for union leadership, no one can run saying these people shouldn't be in the union. It's very hard to do that. What you can run on is say, this person didn't protect you enough, right? I'll protect you even more. The bigots, I'll protect even them. So we have this perverse incentive where union leadership ends up not really representing the values even of the rest of the union members, but they have massive outsized negotiating power. So, yes, engaging with an appropriate right-sizing of labor protections for folks whose jobs are difficult, but who should not be protected from the basic values of human rights, human dignity, and public safety. It's got to be part of the process. I mean, when unions are negotiating a two-year ban on keeping of records so that there's no ability even to trace what's happening in the state of California historically in terms of police misconduct, that's not in the interest of public safety, public legitimacy, or our democracy.
Yeah, the thing I would add, Chris, is that I think the labor union piece is a critically important one to think through. Because I think, like Phil said, they are a key part of the puzzle that we have to solve for. And, you know, it's frustrating when you look at a place like Minneapolis, that Phil knows better than I, but when Mayor Jacob Frey, the one who's on TV all the time, saying, oh, you know, many of the right things that you want elected officials to say at times like this, when he banned his police department from attending the warrior training that was being offered, it was the Minneapolis Police Federation, the local union, that defied him and sent their police to the training. And so we need to really be clear that we need to have the police forces under civilian control. I know this sounds so elementary. I feel like I'm talking about a Latin American kind of totalitarian context, but if we need to kind of exert civilian control of our police in a way that we have yet not been able to think through. And a key part of that is the labor unions of the police. And there are moments when you can find common ground. We brought one of our COVID-related lawsuits to deal with the outbreak of the pandemic in a Maryland jail. We worked really hard. I worked the phones with the head of police unions. We got one of the local unions to serve as plaintiff in our lawsuit. Because we understood that the incarcerated folks who were being denied access to masks and social distancing and the conditions and lack of testing and lack of PPE, that the people who were also going to be in harm's way were going to be the guards as well. And they were going to be the kind of vectors communicating the disease out into the community. So if you can find ways of kind of bringing that relationship, but make no mistake, when you go after their budgets and you start taking away their kind of their munitions and their seat at the budgeting table, or are you going to have a battle on your hands, right? And we have to think about also as we shrink the budgets for police, how do we redeploy people in the police departments to other meaningful jobs, right? Because you can't just throw them on the street and say, you're on your own, you're homeless, good luck to you. That's not a way to deal with redemption. So we have to really think about all these pieces in a much more cohesive way.
We have another question here from the audience. Yeah, from Paul Rucker. The end of summer of 1919, and I think they actually thought it was followed by the Tulsa Race Massacre, the Johnson Agreed Anti-Immigration Act of 1924, and also the rise of the KKK. Is there a possibility that white supremacy will get stronger if we don't seize this opportunity? Rashad, I think this might be something that would be great to hear your perspective on working so deeply in activism.
I'm having a little trouble hearing.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
It's okay.
Can you read the question on the screen, Lesha?
I heard that. I heard you.
Yes. I think it might just be my mic is having some issues here, but is there a possibility that white supremacy will get stronger if we don't see this opportunity? Yeah.
Yes. Absolutely, yes. To be clear, right, if we don't have the right diagnosis of white supremacy, if we think of white supremacy as just hoods, if we think of white supremacy as just folks who are operating, in some of these sort of underground networks that have grown, if we're just thinking about white supremacy and white nationalism as people who march with tiki torches in Charlottesville, then we will really mistake all the ways in which our systems and structures have white supremacy embedded and allow for something like a Tulsa race massacre to happen, something like anti-immigration to happen, but on a day-to-day basis, allow for the targeting of Black communities through predatory practices by banks, the targeting of Black communities through predatory practices like bail, a whole set of systems that can be produced day in and day out. We live in a country where the rules are far too often designed in ways that create a caste system, that create a different standard for some over others. And so when I talked about the inflection point, right, of this moment where something could really go forward or something could turn backwards, we are seeing this right now with this current president. And as we look at what could potentially happening with the next election, we have to be very clear that Donald Trump doesn't just operate on his own. He's enabled by big corporations who benefit from him being in office and so continue to turn a blind eye to all the things that he does. They may post Black Lives Matter, but they show up to the White House and engage with Donald Trump. And then we have a whole set of politicians that may sometimes say that he said something that was wrong, but then but support his platform in other ways. True co-conspiracy in the effort to dismantle white supremacy and white nationalism is not a thing that people can do on vacation. It is a 365-day project of us constantly working to dismantle all of the structures that have been put in harm's way. The final thing I will just add about, because someone mentioned about police unions, and I want to just add that one of the problems with police unions, and many of us have been in this position, I think, is that I have shown up to the table with police unions on many occasions. I remember going to the White House during the last administration and being around a table as we were talking about policing and police reform, and having members of the Fraternal Order Police leadership say things like, all of this talk of racial profiling is new to us. It is one thing for folks to not agree with you on the policy reforms necessary. It is another thing for people to say that our demands are too aspirational. It's another thing to be gaslit and told the problem doesn't actually exist at all. And that is what we are dealing with. And so we have to actually change the way that people see these institutions. Politicians who say that they are on the side of justice and reform can no longer take money from police-only unions and fraternal order police. We actually have to create a new standard, a new litmus test of what does it mean to actually be with us. You can't just sing our songs, use our hashtags, and march in our marches if you are on the other end supporting the structures that put us in harm's way, that literally kill us. And this is the opportunity for white allies to actually stand up in new ways, to do the type of allyship and the type of work that truly dismantles structures, not just provides charity.
I got to add to that. So Paul, thank you for the question. But we're in a moment where a lot of people are looking at what's happening on the street as if a week and a half ago we weren't in the midst of a global pandemic as the greatest news story, the biggest news story going on. One of the things I'm most worried about and have been worried about since the very beginning, what I've been talking to our chiefs about, who we work with, is saying you must be out of the social distancing policing game. You can't be the ones doing that. And the reason is this. We're in a moment where creating scapegoats and enemies and others is incredibly politically advantageous for at least one side. And there's a deliberate efforts to do exactly that. And we've seen that Black communities are 2 and 3 and 4 times more likely to contract this virus, which feels like the manifestation of racial discrimination, because it is. But very soon, that's going to look like Black people made bad choices and they need to stay away from us. And when that happens, that's when law enforcement gets used to regulate where Black movement can be. We used to call it some downtowns. I don't know what we're going to call it when it's around COVID, but it's coming. I'm already seeing that on communities like Nextdoor and on Facebook groups of people who don't think of themselves as white supremacists, but just want the disease away, and the disease has a Black and brown face. So we're not only dealing with a moment of generational tension between Black communities and law enforcement, we're dealing with a moment when people are looking for scapegoats, and Black people's vulnerability has always been our greatest casting note for being cast as scapegoats. So for folks who are worried about this, this is not inevitably a moment for change and reform and enlightenment and America's best values, because historically these have been precisely the moments when regression back to white supremacy has reigned supreme. So let's not just look at everybody signaling. I don't want to just see black and white cops on their knees. I want to see the policies. I want to see the things that will prevent this kind of thing from moving to the next stage.
Rashad, I want to respect that. I know you've got a hard stop at one. So I just want to thank you for your participation in this. If you've got a couple of final words you want to share, that would be great. And then if it's okay for the other three, I think there's just a couple other questions I'd love to put and continue this conversation for just a moment longer, if possible. Rashad, any closing words?
The thing I want to say is that now is the time for action, and I want to invite people in to join us at Color of Change to make justice real. And in so many ways, you can visit us at Color of Change. You can take action. 5, 10, 15 years from now, we will be dealing with the impact of what we did or didn't do in this moment, how we stood up, and how hard we were willing to fight. And as the other speakers have said, now is not the time for reform around the edges. Now is time for dismantling the policies and practices that have held us back and championing solutions and new rules that will move us forward. And so we hope that you will do something, whether it's with us or whether it's with local organizations in your community or other groups around the country. But this is an opportunity to make change, and I believe that we can make justice real if we find the passion and the energy to work together to achieve it. So thank you all for having me, and I hope that we have an opportunity to build not just online but offline in the months to come.
Thanks so much, Rashad.
I'm going to stop right there because there's so much to digest. Here we have a lot of individuals, or actually four remarkable individuals who are on the front lines, CEOs, dealing with all of the different elements of racism and are discussing dismantling the systems of oppression and racism and the responsibility for tragedies that, like the murder of Taylor and Floyd and far too many others, and explore how the U.S. can start to live up to its ideals. This discussion hosted by the head of TED, Chris Anderson, and discussed the current affairs coordinator, Whitney Pennington Rogers. This was recorded in June 3rd, 2020. And by the way, you've been listening to Getting It Done, and I've been your host, Dr. Walter Dean. Just a few more statements that I'd like to make before we conclude today's show. I'm not going to stay the whole time. There's a number of things that I want to bring to your attention. We can talk and we can continue to talk. But they say that action always speaks louder than words. It was just too bad that people can't move towards putting together workshops in different communities to discuss and work on some of the issues related to this and share that information throughout the United States. Conferences also can take place dealing with the issues related to institutional racism and its cohorts. And if we do that, where people can discuss strategies and get ready to implement those particular strategies in these conferences and workshops, also in the promotion of different kinds of, I would believe, courses, but that would be because of the pandemic, it would be impossible, where people can get together and go through reverse strength training, then with all of the three components that I just mentioned, conferences when our country is not in a pandemic sickness stage, but we can still do it virtually. You don't have to wait until people can sit in on audience. Because you see, you can say certain kinds of things and people will then turn around and say, oh, we can't do that, mainly because it's impossible for us because of the pandemic. And the people will then say, okay, no, you're going to get sick. And because of that, you won't be able to do anything at all. But where there's a will, there's a way. And with the advent of modern technology and telephone conferencing and computer activity that would allow for all kinds of conferences and workshops to take place, people can actually sit down through that particular vehicle and that medium and make things happen. So those particular individuals laid down the gauntlet, telling you precisely of the kinds of things and the institutions that are causing all the problems, and then also the ways that they can be dealt with. But more importantly, those are words. Now we need action. And the only way you're going to get action is people are involved in the different kinds of action-oriented activities. So this has been Getting It Done. And it's Friday. Have a nice weekend. And we will talk to you again on Monday. Have a good day.